My guest today is often described by other people I've interviewed so far as the reporter's reporter. George Garrett, who spent most of his career at CKNW, but he started out on the prairies.
I started out in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, CJNB. I got the job because I'd always been interested in radio, and I hitchhiked up there. I'd had no money, of course. 1952, and I'm 17 years old, and I took an audition. The program manager at the time was Tommy Nelson. He told me later, he said, "George, I didn't hire you because of your voice. I hired you because you showed some initiative." And that's how I got going. That's where I met my wife, and we still go back there.
What was your first job at the radio station?
Announcer. You know, the old wire copy used to say, "This is announcer's name," and you try to get your voice down, of course. This is George Garrett with the news, and it was a rip-and-read operation. I knew absolutely nothing about news.
Was there somebody there who was your mentor, who taught you about news?
Not really, until I got to my hometown station, which was CHAB Moose Jaw. I'd always wanted to work there, of course, and there was a guy there named Bob Giles, who was a very, very good broadcaster. After I'd been there a short time, he put me on what I thought was quite innovative for its time, a half-hour news show based on the Today, Time magazine format, politics, religion, business, economy, and sports, of course. I was given that responsibility, and it was quite a learning experience.
So you put that show together yourself?
Pretty well. With help from people in the newsroom, but I was the guy that voiced it and so on. One little anecdote about that show, the fellow that did it before me was named George Price, a meticulous, very careful person. And like so many of us in radio at the time, he smoked. I smoked. But he would read his stuff over. And then he'd, about 10 minutes before the 6 o'clock newscast, he would put the copy down somewhere and go out and have a cigarette and come back in. Inadvertently, he put the news copy on the lid of a tape recorder. Joe Sports Guy comes in. His name was Paul Hack, actually. Grabbed the lid of the tape recorder, closed it with the copy still in it, took off. 2 minutes to six, George Price discovers, "I don't have a newscast." The newsroom was one floor below. So he got on the phone and he said, "Bring me some copy, anything, wire copy, I don't care, anything." But he sat there, and for the first 3 or 4 minutes, he ad-libbed the stories that he remembered rehearsing. That's radio.
Some of the people you worked with at CJNB.
I can remember a young fellow named Brian Donnelly, who came in from somewhere back east. His claim to fame was that he ripped off some merchants in town. We had a few fraud artists then. The library guy came over, one of the directors of the library, absolutely demanding that I return a book and that kind of thing. I can remember another fellow named Mac McCalder, who had one artificial leg, worked with us for a while and went up to Edmonton, and I think did quite well up there. I worked with a fellow named Don Brown, who was a pool shark. He could take anybody in town.
And probably supplemented his income that way.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure. And I can still remember how he sounded. And when I drive through the town of Vermilion, Alberta, I think of him because we used to have the weather forecast for the Lloydminster Vermilion area, one in Saskatchewan, and partly in Saskatchewan, and then, of course, Vermilion in Alberta. And it was just the way he said Vermilion. And the guys I worked with then, really liked them. They were great guys.
You learn a lot at the first station.
Oh, sure. Some stayed in radio, some did not.
You moved on to CHAB, as you mentioned. Who were some of the people that were working there with you?
Bob Giles, who was, I guess, my mentor. He was the program director. And I remember one little incident where they sent me to Regina on a Sunday night to do an interview with somebody about the Crow's Nest Pass freight rates, which were big on the prairies, as you know. I did the interview, but I took the station car in order to do it. I think it was a 53 Pontiac. And I thought, well, if I'm having to do this interview, why don't I just have the car for a while and go visit my old friend Tom Nelson, my first production manager. So I went to visit him in Regina, and I'm coming home about 2 a.m. through a blizzard, and the car ran out of gas. I had to wake up a farmer to get going again. And when I pulled in the morning, I think it was by 7 o'clock this time, and Jay Letty, our morning man, said, "George, have you got the station car?" And I said, "Yeah, why?" He said, "Nev Skingle, the assistant manager, is looking for it, and you're in trouble." So I had to go up and see Bob Giles, who was my program director and my boss, knowing that I was in trouble for unauthorized use of the station car. You know what he said? "George, station cars for station business. Got it?" "Yes, Bob." "That's all." That was it.
Didn't get fired.
No. And he's the guy that got me out to CKNW. Gave me a good recommendation because I was 21 at the time, and the CKNW in those days didn't hire 21-year-old people. But he gave me a good recommendation, and it worked out.
And so CHAB, how long did you stay there?
I guess it was about a year, that's all. I went back to North Battleford because my girlfriend was there, now my wife of 54 years. I got the job of program director. You know, I knew nothing. I used to say that, you know, it's too bad because people like me were inflicted upon the public with absolutely no training. You know, sometimes mispronunciations of words or improper use of phrasing and so on. You learn as you go, and hopefully you learn enough, but I was pretty lucky. I had a good career.
Good trainers. Then you moved in 1955 to CKNW.
Well, 56. I started February 1st, 56. I started in 56 as a newsman. I learned from Jim Cox, who was my news director then. Les White was... whose real name was Henri Michaud. They felt it was too French, so he used his wife's name. Her name was Leslie White, so he called himself Les White. There was a wonderful guy named Bill Duncan and Warren Barker, who became my boss eventually, my true mentor in all these years. A lot of good people like George Sillery, I think he's gone now. We just had a terrific staff at CKNW. Hal Davis was our program director, Bill Hughes, our manager.
What was your first job in the newsroom?
Working on the desk, we had a system called pilot and co-pilots. I would be in the co-pilot's chair quite often, sometimes working alongside Bob Giles, who would come out to CKNW. I learned a lot. We did a lot of stuff by phone. We didn't have a news cruiser then. Our first roving reporter was Mark Rains, who subsequently became a member of parliament. Mark had a 53 Ford with no cell phone, no nothing. Just a tape recorder, a Wirec tape recorder, which you wind up. Mel Cooper was our sales manager, and he sold Sunbeam Bread on the idea of sponsoring a news cruiser, which was brand new. Bill Fox was the first fellow to drive it. His name, he was called Barometer Bill. He used to do a lot of the weather forecasts. I guess he wasn't a perfect match for it. It wasn't his bag, so they put me out in the news cruiser. Sunbeam Bread radio news cruiser. Kids used to go down the streets in Safferton and say, George Garrett, Sunbeam Bread radio news cruiser.
What kind of equipment did you have besides the Wirec? Was there a two-way radio set up at all at that time?
Initially, there was nothing, and then they eventually put in the VHF so I could contact the desk. And then they had, the car was a 58 Chev station wagon. It was a beautiful car, and it had a lot of writing on it. Those days, CKNW was 1320 on the dial. They had a facsimile of a loaf of Sunbeam Bread on the one side. The Top Dog logo, you know, it was really garish. And Bob Giles, who was such a character, called me one night on the two-way. George, Hal Davis just called. Yes? Wants to know if it's okay with you if we put the program schedule on the roof for apartment dwellers.
Was he joking or
yes,
serious?
Yes, he was joking.
Oh, good.
But the Sunbeam Bread was the first one. And after that, we had cigarette sponsors. Peter Stuyvesant was one of them. My job was to file as many reports as I could.
Now, did you carry a portable typewriter back then? Or were you doing shorthand or notes?
I had learned shorthand in school. I was a kid dropout in grade 11. But, so although I knew Greg's shorthand, I never really did use it. So I just made short notes. And I used to get my notebooks free from the police department, the same ones that the policemen used. So that's all I had.
Did you file by phone then, or did you use the VHF?
Almost always by phone.
So you had a roll of quarters in your pocket.
Dimes in those
dimes.
Days.
Dimes, sorry.
Yeah, it was dimes.
That goes back before my time.
And I knew where every free phone was. I knew where every pay phone was. Covering things in the courthouse, you know, my objective was get the verdict and get out there quickly before anybody else gets on the air. So I'd have the phone staked out, the dimes in my pocket. But most of my stories, as years went along, a lot of them became ad libs because I wanted the pressure of getting information right up to the last minute and get it on the air and ad lib it. And after a while, you get kind of a formula, you know, fill in the name and the place, and it's a murder or it's a robbery or it's a strike or an assault or whatever it is, or a fire.
Your former co-workers have told me everybody knows George Garrett and George Garrett knows everybody. They said you used to get scoops over the other newsrooms, and back in those days, every radio station had a pretty good newsroom, and there was a lot of competition to get the story, get it first, and get it right. And they said that if there was a big story out there, George would have it first.
Well, certainly not always, but I got lots of lucky breaks. Fairly recently, I was in the newsroom with the Surrey Leader, and Dan Ferguson, who had been in radio, great voice, he'd been in radio, and he said, George, he said, I was at WX. I was told about you, and I was told that your reputation was overblown, that it was all a lot of hot air, etc., etc. So he said, my first couple of weeks in the newsroom at WX were scrambling to catch up on a story. And the news director came in and he said, where'd that story come from? And he said, that overblown reporter you talked about, Garrett.
So you carried on as a reporter then until the mid-60s, mm-hmm. and then it says you went into sales.
Yeah, I thought that I would climb the corporate ladder. Yeah, what a mistake. You know, I went into sales. It was actually about 65, I think, and I was making, you know, fair money as a newsman. But I thought, well, the big money's in sales. Well, wake up, George. You know, after, I think, a few months, they guaranteed me a salary for a few months, and then it was, you're on your own, buddy. It's commission. So I really had to work at it. I was certainly not a natural salesman. My wife says that I'm really a newsman. Well, I had the sales thing for a while, and then I became the manager of CFMI, the first FM station that NW had, Rock 101 now, same frequency. I got hired away by a guy in Trail. His name was Lloyd Houle. I'd known Lloyd for many years. He'd been at CJOR. He was a great broadcaster. And he gave me a job as manager of the radio station in Trail. You talk about people being elevated to their level of incompetence. That was me.
You felt that way?
Yeah, I did. I proved it, actually. I lasted 5 months and I got fired. And I get emotional when I talk about it. But, you know, here I am having moved my family to Trail, left a beautiful home in Surrey or Delta. All of it, and I had a house up in Trail too, but all of a sudden I'm out of a job, which I'd never been in my life. And, you know, it was degrading. It was humiliating. So I phoned Warren Barker, told him that I'd been fired. And his exact words were, what? He said, that's astonishing. He said, if you'd like to come back here, he said, just come and see me. So I did. I walked in his office, and among the first things he said was, well, George, you have a job. I'll pay you the best I can for a senior reporter, but you're free to look around at television, other radio stations, newspapers, whatever you want to do, but you know you've got a job.
We sort of skipped over this a bit in your first stint at CKNW from 55 to 64. Who are some of the people that you were working with in that era?
Maury Hesketh comes to mind. You know, he was such a character. Greg Carmichael, who went on to CTV. Henry Shannon. I've got a whole barrel full of records, he would say. He filled in for Jerry Davies on The All Night Show. And that was his shtick, a whole barrel full of records. But he wound up as a very, very successful eye in the sky guy in
Toronto.
CFRB, mm-hmm. Toronto. I mentioned Jerry Davies, who was our all-night man. And a story goes there. We were in the Columbia Street in New Westminster, 227 Columbia, which is where the Sky Train runs through now. And we're right next door to Nelson, or above Nelson's Laundry, and next door to a funeral home. And one night, the safe was blown at Nelson's Laundry. And of course, the New Westminster police were investigating. They came up and they talked to Maury Hesketh, who'd been in news that night. They talked to Jerry Davies, the all-night man. No, he hadn't heard a thing. Hesketh, being a character, said to poor Jerry Davies, who was a worrywart, he said, you know, the cops thinks you're in on that. He said, what? Well, you should have heard it. You were the only guy here all night. Oh, Jerry said, I didn't hear it. That was Hesketh. One of his little antics was he was mad about something and, like, really angry. He picked up a typewriter. We had Olympia typewriters. He threw it at the wall, and it caused a break in the gyprock, a hole in the wall. And Warren Barker, who was the news director at the time, walked by and he said, oh, my goodness, what happened here? He went and got the biggest calendar he could find and hung the calendar over the hole.
Did it ever get fixed?
No, I don't think it ever did. Oh, and I was working with Al Davidson, sports guy who was famous. Among the things he did was, he was at the same studio, 227 Columbia. He was angry about something when he came off the air. I think it was the operator who was a disc jockey running the tapes. We didn't have a provision for starting your own tapes. And we had reel-to-reel, not even cartridges. I think the guy didn't hit his cue properly or something for Al for a sports clip. So Al comes out of the news booth, didn't matter than hell, and he kicked a metal box in the hallway. It put us off the air because it was the relay box. So the engineer, who was from my hometown of Moose Jaw, Leo Hademach, went out and bought a cake pan in the store, screwed the cake pan on top of the box so that if anybody kicked it again, it wouldn't likely put us off the air.
Let's skip ahead then past Trail. You came back to CKNW and you were the senior reporter in, I believe, mid-70s.
Yes.
And who are some of the people you were working with besides Warren Barker at that time?
My old friend John McKittrick, whom I've been working with for many, many years. John and I, he's from North Battleford where I started. and I think about 1 year behind me in starting in radio. And for the most part of some 40 years, we worked in the same station together. Many times he was my superior in the sense that he was the pilot, the editor of the shift.
He was also assignment editor
for a long time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what we called him. And his biggest challenge was to find Garrett. Where is he now? So he was, you know, he would call on the VHF, Garrett alive?
So by that time, you were working with the VHF more than telephones.
Yeah, we had the telephone, a cell phone by then. But speaking of cell phones, during Expo, John knew that I kind of have a preference for white spot hamburgers and triple O sauce. So John Ashbridge, Bell Puri, and maybe Mike Colleen, a few of us anyway from radio, or mostly NW, are sitting in the white spot at Expo. My pager goes off, and it was a voice pager, and it goes beep, 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 and you hear McKittrick's voice. Garrett, wipe that triple O sauce off your face and call the desk. That's exactly what I was doing, eating a hamburger and the sauce. So McKittrick was one of the guys I worked with. Gosh, there were many others. Clark Housley was one who later went on to, I think, BC Tel or TELUS now. Doug Strachan I worked with. Chris Olson. Chris was a great reporter. I've never known a guy, Chris had a degree in commerce, but I've never known a guy who could look at a financial report and tell you within 30 seconds what this is all about. And he would do the same with court judgments. As you know, we'd follow a court case. If it went through Supreme Court, there'd be reasons for judgment.
And you'd get a brief that would be 2 or 3 inches thick, and you could go through that.
Several pages long, and you're on deadline, or you think you are. You want to beat the next guy. And Chris had the ability to thumb through to the back page, get the decision of the judge, flip back a few, and a lot of us remembered every case, you know, because we worked on them a lot. We
followed them, yes.
Yeah, and he would ad-lib an absolutely perfect story of what this judgment said. Well, I had a reputation, I guess, for being able to do it. One of them was the terrible, terrible case. It was a Johnson-Bentley murders, Clearwater, BC. They'd been missing it for so long, and no one could find them. Obviously, they had been murdered, or something terrible had happened to them. When the bodies were found, I had such a good source. It was just unbelievable. The guy phoned me. George, they found the Johnson and the Bentleys. And I said, where? In the bush. Their camper had been burned out so many yards or so many meters from the road. And I questioned him about, were the bodies of the children there? No, they were not. The bodies of a lot of detail that only a guy at the scene would know. I was really skeptical, so I phoned him back, and I said, tell me again. So he told me the same thing all over again, everything checked. So I then phoned the RCMP, and they spooked, of course. They put me through to the superintendent, and I said, sir, this is what I have, and I intend to go on the air with it unless you tell me there's a reason not to. He said, I have no comment. And I said, sir, this is really important. I said, I don't really want comment. I want to know if this is accurate. He said, I told you I have no comment. Bang, hung up. So I checked with Warren, you know, things like that I did. And Warren said, if you know your source is correct, go with it, which I did. And the station in Kamloops, which is to this day the best news station in the province, I think, CHNL. Jim Harrison and Angelo Iacobucci, Bob Price. At any rate, one of the guys, I don't know if it was Jim or Angelo, I guess when they heard my story fed down the line about the Johnson Bentleys, they thought, wait a minute. This is really big stuff. So they phoned the RCMP and they denied it. So they called the desk and got McKittrick and they said, what do we do? We've got George's story and we've got the RCMP denying it. McKittrick said, who do you believe, Garrett or the RCMP? And they ran it. To my regret, really, they had not informed the parents, mm-hmm. the family yet. And I blame the RCMP for that, you mm-hmm. know, and I've been a great staunch supporter of the RCMP for
well,
years.
Your ethics are unquestionable.
Oh, thank you.
And have been for decades. And I know there are reporters out there who would have killed to steal your contact book.
You know what they used to say? I bought one of those Casio
little handheld
things, and I've forgotten how many names, a lot of names in it. And one of them said, Garrett, I want your Casio. Put it in your will. I want it.
Yeah, there were a lot of numbers, I think, in there that other people, as I said, would have killed to have.
I used to get calls even after I retired saying, could you give me a home number for Bill Bennett? You know, things like
which
that.
Which you had?
Yeah, I did. I didn't call him very often. But I used to get calls once in a while. And we had one story, I suppose, which was fairly big, is that Bill Bennett and some other people were charged with insider trading, Bennett Doman, the Bennett Doman case. I was around the courthouse one day. I got a tip from a lawyer that hey, maybe you should look at this. And in the meantime, the Globe and Mail had done a story about insider trading identifying a company, but not the individuals. So I went to some people who were in a position to know and said, you know, is there any connection here? And he said, yeah, Bill Bennett's one of the inside traders, his brother Russell.
Oh, oh. George smells a big story.
Yeah, yeah. So there, once again, I went to Warren and said, you know, I've got this. I know it's true, but I'll never get verification unless there's a charge laid. And he said, well, go with it. So I did. And so help me, I was getting calls from the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star. And I remember one of them said, what's your source? I said, you got to be kidding.
I'm going to tell you. We all jealously guarded our really good sources.
Of course.
Yeah.
And one occasion, I did a story about a body found on a mountain in North Vancouver. My story was to the effect that the perpetrator had gone to a lawyer. The lawyer took 4 days to go to the police and tell them about it. And I was wrong in some aspects of it. It was, you know, maybe 2 days instead of 4 days or something. But the basic story was right, but the timeline was wrong. The guy that I did the story against, the lawyer who supposedly took so long to report it, sued me. And that's the first and only time I'd ever been sued. And I was a bit nervous about it. So I went to Bill Hughes, our then manager, and I told him I had been called to, it's called an examination for discovery, and I was called upon to reveal my source, and I declined to do it. And I was given that opportunity, I guess, two or three times during this examination, and I said, I'm unable to tell you. I just can't do it. And so I was cited for contempt of court. It was going to be a question of whether we're going to carry on or just throw in the towel. So I went to Bill Hughes and I said, I hate to ask you this, but I'd like you to settle out of court so that we don't have to reveal the source and I don't go to jail. So he agreed, and the settlement was $1,500, just chicken feed.
Bill was extremely supportive of the news department.
Very, very.
Unlike many managers who look at news as a huge expense and a tune-out.
No, he understood. I can remember an incident where a car dealer was really angry about a story about the odometer being rolled back. That was his practice. It wasn't my story, somebody else on staff. The salesman for the, you know, was selling advertising to this firm, was just ranting and raving about, you know, this is my client, you can't do it to him. And Bill said, hey, you know, he has a way of speaking. I can't imitate him, but the client buys advertising because CKNW has an audience. It does not guarantee him protection from wrongdoing. He buys us because we're worth buying. And you go back and tell him that. Yeah, he was a great supporter in the newsroom. To this day, you know, I've been retired 11 years now, I think. Bill has a function at least once a year where he invites all the old, like McKittrick and myself and several others, John Plewell, invites us to lunch at his club, his golf club in Beech Grove. He never loses touch with us. And on one occasion when a chorus took over CKNW, they sent us all the retirees a letter saying that your benefits would no longer be in effect. Well, Bill just hit the roof, and he phoned the head guy, a guy at Chorus in Toronto, and he said, when you bought CKNW, you bought the assets, but you also bought the liabilities, and that includes looking after the retired people. And if you don't rescind that letter, I'll see you in court. Well, within 2 weeks, we got a letter rescinding the previous one. And those benefits are
so
important.
He still carried a lot of clout.
He does.
And still does.
And cares a great deal about his
people. About his people. I think the only other person I can think of who was really the same was Alan Waters at Chum, who treated everyone like family.
Yes.
And you were a valued member of his radio family.
I had an occasion to meet Alan Waters, and I was kind of a young guy running CFMI. I didn't know anything, but he came in to CFMI, and we were in the CKNW studios in New Westminster then. He was giving the arguments pro and con for a rock format or an MOR format on one side of the room, and he said, this is why a rock format will sell. He gave you a sales pitch, you know, that would just blow your socks off. Then he crossed the room and he said, on the other hand, if you wanted to sell an MOR format, these are the good points. Talk about a salesman.
Yes.
My God.
Yeah. Well, he started out selling patent medicine, of all
really?
Things. That was his first first job.
What a career.
Yeah. And what a gentleman.
Oh,
My favorite radio boss of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Great.
You moved from basically what we used to call beat or general reporting into investigative reporting.
Thanks to Warren Barker, really. I had never even thought of the term investigative. I knew about an organization called IRE, Investigative Reporters and Editors, which is based in the United States. Very, very good. But I didn't classify myself as an investigative reporter, but that's the title Warren gave me, and he said, go find a story.
Pick a topic and develop it.
Yeah. So it had a lot of advantages. You didn't have to follow the assignment sheet. You just sort of developed your own stories. And I had a lot of faults, and one of them was wanting to be there when the big story is on. You know, and some of the people I worked with resented that, and I don't blame them, but I would show up for the big stories. I tried to be the kind of guy that was helpful. Sometimes we'd have five reporters on a story, you know, we'd ad-lib it, five different people doing it, men and women. And to me, it was great radio. But, you know, once in a while, they used to say, you know, Garrett's raiding us again. He should go away and work out his own stuff. But it was mostly behind the scenes and not too open. But nonetheless, we got along quite well.
You retired in 1999. Mm-hmm. Was that your decision, or was that a decision that was made by the new owners?
No, it was mine, although I knew the station was being sold. I've forgotten the timeline, but it always had been a family operation. Even when we were in the fancy black tower, you know, we cared for each other. We worked well together. I sensed that something was coming, and in my own situation, I thought that I was not quite as successful as I had been. I was making mistakes on stories that I really shouldn't do. I just thought it was about time to pack it in. Now, before that, I had decided, or asked with permission, I took 2 months off. 2 months off in a year, and then I'd go back and work and so on. It was the wrong thing to do, because if you're going to work, you should work. And I felt I was losing it. And I thought, well, rather go out on a high note. I didn't ask for anything. I didn't ask for a package. I didn't get one. Fortunately, a good pension, because I'd been there so long. But I never asked for a dime. As it turns out, I went to work with the Pace Group, media guy, media training and so on. And they were instrumental in putting on a retirement for me, and the station was very helpful as well. It ended well.
You have picked up some notables. You're a member of the Canadian Association of Broadcasters, which has just made itself defunct. Half Century Club. They've gone out of business. They're trying to reorganize. Radio Television News Directors Association Lifetime Achievement Award in 2004.
On the wall here. Yeah.
But there's also
Jack Webster.
The Jack Webster Award.
Yeah, that means a lot. Not that the others don't, but the Jack Webster one, it really recognizes two outstanding individuals in journalism in this province over the years. It's named the Bruce Hutchison Award for Lifetime Achievement, named for the late Bruce Hutchison, who was a great newsman with the Vancouver Sun. He ended up as writer emeritus or something like that. He's an outstanding man. And the other, of course, was Jack Webster. You gave me a compliment at the opening there about a reporter's reporter. Well, I didn't thought of it that way, but Jack Webster did write a book when he retired. And unlike most Scotsmen, I didn't have to buy it. He gave me a copy of his book. Anyway, he wrote in the flyleaf to Jarch, a reporter's reporter. Best of luck, Jack Webster. Well, I was thrilled with that. And poor old Jack, when he was in his last weeks, really, I went to see him. He was at St. Vincent's Hospital. And he was in what I would call like a baby tenda, a table on wheels. He sits in the middle and propels himself around with his feet. He still knew me, and he was upset about something, medicine or whatever. He said, "Jarch, you'll get to the bottom of this." He still thought I could do a story about it.
You've had so many great stories. What were some of your favorite moments, what you felt were your crowning achievements in your career?
Well, the Bennett Doman story was pretty big in that I was quite flattered to be getting news calls from the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, asking for a source, that kind of thing. Another one was poor old E. Davy Fulton, who was a very fine man, really. He was a judge in the BC Supreme Court, referred to as Mr. Justice E. Davy Fulton. He had been our justice minister in Canada in the Diefenbaker years. Wonderful man. But one night, I'd asked the police department some weeks before that to do a ride-along. And most ride-alongs, as you may know, are 2 days or 1 day. So I went to the then chief, Don Winterton, and I said, "Sir, I'd like to do a ride-along for a whole month." "Oh, well, you better bring your boss in here and we'll see." So Warren came down with me. There's Don Winterton, the chief, and there are three deputy chiefs, Ted Oliver, Tom Dixon, and Bob Stewart. I said, "Well, here's my plan. This is what I want to do." They approved it. Tom Dixon was skeptical, but, you know, the chief was all for it. So just as I was leaving, I said, "Oh, by the way, sir, I'd like to take along a tape recorder." He said, a tape recorder. I said, well, of course. I said, the newspaper people use pad and pencil and radio guys use tape recorders. Oh, all right. I said, I'll give you an undertaking never to use anything that will compromise a case or compromise an individual. If, you know, this, for example, if a member says his sergeant is a jerk, you know, I said, I'm not going to use that kind of stuff. Okay, fine, go ahead. So I was on this project for 3 or 4 weeks and got lots of good stories out of it. But one night, nearing the end of it, we're in South Vancouver, which is, they work out of, at that time, 41st and Cambie, and the police call it Ponderosa. You know, it's the, out in the ranch. Nothing happens out there. It's in a patrol car, and we're driving down South Granville, and we get a call to an MVA, motor vehicle accident. And as we drive up, I see this gentleman, well-dressed, outside of his vehicle. Is obviously damaged, has hit another vehicle, and it's Mr. Justice E. Davy Fulton. So I very quietly said to the guys, I said, do you know who that is? No. I said, that's Mr. Justice E. Davy Fulton. One of them said, oh, Christ, call a supervisor. So a corporal came, and they didn't want any hassle at all. They didn't want to arrest him. All they wanted to do was get him off the road. So they said, sir, we're issuing you a 24-hour suspension. And he said, go to hell. Very well, if you do that, I shall not be a judge anymore. And I'm standing within 5 feet of him with a tape recorder out in the open, getting all this on tape. So I phoned my boss, Warren, and I said, this is what I have. It's only a 24-hour suspension. Should we give the guy a break? And he said, yeah. He said, just keep the tape. Unknown to me, Harry Phillips, whom I also worked with, great reporter, got a tip from another policeman about Fulton having been involved in another accident the very same night on the nearby Arthur Lang Bridge. And Harry ran with it without checking. It's his right to do it. I got a call from a lawyer representing Mr. Fulton. Sir Garrett, we're just wondering whether this is really necessary to go on the air. And it was, you know, before I knew about the second one. So I said, well, I've talked to my boss and we're going to hold off and I'm going to keep the tape as he instructed me to do. He said, well, that's very good of you. He said, I'm speaking from Mr. Justice Davy Fulton's study. And I said, well, I think he's a fine man and I'm sorry this happened. But next thing I know, on the air, it was Harry's story. He had been impaired driving on the Arthur Lang Bridge. So, of course, I had the tape. So we went with it with, you know, number two. As it happened, Sun and Province were on strike at the time. And the newspaper of the day was put out by the union. It was called the Vancouver Express. They heard the story on the air. Of course, everybody monitored NW. Headline, go to hell, judge tells cops.
Great story.
Oh, yes. You know, I felt badly for Mr. Fulton. I really liked the man. It's just one of those things. He had an alcoholic problem. And
was there ever a story you covered where you felt your life might have been in danger?
Well, I was in Los Angeles and was covering the Rodney King riots, and the lead up to that is that the riots had been going. Rodney King was the fellow who was beaten by the police in Los Angeles, and a jury in Simi County, which is near Los Angeles, far removed from what it's like in downtown L.A., they acquitted the police officers. Well, place went nuts. You know, taxi drivers, mostly black guys, jamming their cars to a stop and screaming, and fires broke out, looting. It was a terrible, terrible situation. And Doug Rutherford, who was my program director, called me after that one night of rioting, and he said, George, you know what you need? I said, what, Doug? He said, you need some time in the California sun. Oh, I said, am I covering the riots? Yeah, would you mind? I said, no, I'd love to. So I went down there.
Did they give you a flak jacket or a bulletproof
nothing,
vest? Or
nothing.
Anything?
I get down there and rented a car right out at the airport. And I found I couldn't go very far because everything was locked down. So I was listening to the radio and I could tell what was happening all over town. And I'm cribbing stuff off the radio and filing by phone, getting it on the air. I got to my hotel and I wasn't allowed to go any further. It was on Century Boulevard, I remember. So I was going out on the street, interviewing anybody who came by. Tripped them if I had to. You know, to get, you know what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. And the next morning, some of the curfews had been lifted, but Bill Goodshow called, and his producer, Gladys Johnson, said, Bill wants you to find out what the church is doing about the riots and so on. I said, good plan. So I drove up to a street. I stopped at a gas station. And there was a black gentleman there rolling a gate back and forth, which was routine procedure to prevent gas theft. Very nice gentleman. And I said, sir, could you tell me, it's Western Avenue, it was called. I said, is there a church nearby? He said, yes, sir. There's one about 3 blocks down here on the right. I said, oh, thanks a lot. He said, I wouldn't go down there if I were you. I said, oh, I'll be all right. I drove down there, parked the car, found somebody in the church and interviewed them, and they were doing a lot for the people there. But as I walked through the streets, just about every window was blackened and smashed. places had been looted, except for ones that had a little sign that said brother owned or black owned, something like that. But I was calling in, I had been calling a lot of reports to across Canada for the various WIC stations they were called then. And 12:30 came along and I was all queued up to go on Bill's show. Talked to the producer and said, yeah, I'm standing by. Bill went to put me on the air. No George. It was gone. What had happened was these four guys came along and I had a rental car there and they said, is this your car? I said, yes. Give me the keys. I said, no. Give me the keys. No, I said, you wouldn't hurt an old guy. It's got nothing to do with being old. You're white. Wham. He grabbed my microphone and hit me probably with the mic in the face. Down I went, bleeding profusely. And they took off because somebody yelled. And it was a guy across the street, also a black guy. He came running over and he hollered over. He said, you all right? And I said, no, I need help. So he came running over. He says, what happened to you? And I said, these guys attacked me. They wanted my keys. He said, should have given it to them. He said, is that your car there? I said, yes. He said, I'll drive it to the hospital. I know where the hospital is. He said, we'll get you to the hospital. My girlfriend will follow in my car. So he got me to the hospital with the car. And I went through x-rays, and I didn't realize what was going on. But I do remember, and I better phone my wife, so I phoned Joan. She was working as a hairdresser, and I called her, and I was crying on the phone, and I said, I've been assaulted. She said, where are you? And I said, I don't know. She said, put down the phone and go to the information desk and ask them which hospital you're in and then come back and tell me. Well, she was so calm. And that's exactly what I did. After the x-rays, it was time to leave the hospital. So I knew it was dangerous. So I said to the commissioner, I said, if you could find somebody to drive me back to my hotel, I'll pay their cab fare back. He said, I'd like to help you, sir, but I don't have anyone. So I had to drive back through the ghetto. And I was more nervous then than I was before I got assaulted. And I was watching every car, and I finally pulled up to the traffic light. I waited till I saw a non-white or a non-black person. I said it was a white guy. I said, how do I get to Century Boulevard to my hotel? He said, straight ahead, about 5 blocks. I said, thank you very much. And so I got to the hotel. I could show you here. I didn't want to quit working because it was still a good story. So I was listening to the radio and watching TV and cribbing stuff from them, and I told the story about a carjacking. And what I was doing was making a few notes and kind of ad-libbed the story. But I had my notepad, and as I was speaking, I recorded it so I wouldn't screw it up. And as I'm speaking into my recorder, the bud is spattering on my notepad. My boss, Gordon McDonald, insisted on coming down to take me home, which was totally unnecessary. But Peter Montague, a SAP sergeant in the RCMP, was then down there on another course, and he knew what was happening to me, and he was going to have the RCMP fly their plane down to get me home.
Let's end this on a happier note. Tell me about some of your favorite people with whom you've worked right from the beginning through to the end.
I've mentioned a couple of them. I would say number one would have to be Warren Barker. He was the ultimate professional newsman. He worked extremely hard. He would get up 2 and 3 in the morning and come in, and he'd have his 8 o'clock news ready by 6 o'clock. Every story was perfectly written. There were no typos, no grammatical errors. He was what you should be as a radio newsman. He had a sense of how to let his people do their thing. He wasn't over your shoulder all the time saying, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Even with me, and I'm a sort of a self-assigning reporter, not tied down to one thing, he would never tell me, well, why don't you go with this? You haven't had a story on this. I knew if I hadn't had a story, he didn't have to tell me, or if I screwed up on one. I made a trip to Washington once thinking something was going to happen on the lumber tariffs, and it was a wasted effort, wasted money. Never said a word. So Warren Barker would be number one. McKittrick's a guy, John McKittrick, I've always enjoyed working with. Another true professional. He worked extremely hard, and, you know, he was dedicated, and it just killed him if we were ever scooped on anything. I could tell you one anecdote that has one profanity in it, if you'll allow. Ted Field, another young fellow I worked with, we had a story about the federal government deciding to pay reparations to Japanese for what happened to them during the war. And the Sun had a scoop on it. In the meantime, they called a news conference for 10 o'clock in the morning, but the story's already in the Sun. And we used to pick up the Sun on the street and phone in the headlines to make sure we knew what they had. And McKittrick was so upset at that, he'd sent Ted to the news conference to get the story on the reparations. And we saw the Sun story or heard about it, called Ted on his pager, voice pager, turned up loud, room full of reporters and officials. McKittrick says to Ted, Ted, it's in the Sun. Shit on the floor and get out.
And everybody heard this.
Oh, of course. McKittrick's another guy I really enjoyed working with. Bob Giles, my mentor in Moose Jaw. George Price, I mentioned. Chris Olson, Bell Puri, Yvonne Emore. I'm sure a lot of people that you know.
Mm-hmm.
You
know. A lot of people I worked with for my relatively short time at CKNW.
I was on a course, Bell was on a course down in Ontario, and she, with me, covered the convention of that elected Trudeau, I think it was, in 68. Bell is a class person. I really got along well with her. Doriana Temelo is another. Doriana was a terrific gal, and she did an outstanding job uncovering the death of Terry Fox. These are things that, you know, you kind of relate people with stories they're covered and the way they covered them. You know, as I said, Chris Olson was in a class by himself.
Radio dramatically changed in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations began taking over family-owned businesses. The bottom line became more important than the product. Is there any hope for radio today? Do you listen to any radio? Do you think radio has a future?
Well, I listen to WX more than NW. You know, I have some loyalty to NW, but not the same. I guess I would phrase it this way. If I tune into WX, I get the news without attitude. I get a lot of attitude on some of the stories that are done by either talk show hosts or whatever on NW.
Pushing the line toward editorialism.
Yeah, pretty well. And I was criticized for that at times, you know, and I realized I had done it. You know, I've been with Rafe Mayer quite a bit on the air, and I do editorial stuff with him because quite often would argue with him about points.
But people knew that was an editorial.
Yeah,
that,
Intrepid Report.
We always, the best newsmen always tried to keep that out of the newscast.
I did, and news stories I tried to, but Rafe called me the Intrepid Reporter. But I did editorial comment on his show, and I found out later, and when I retired, actually, that Gordon MacDonald, my news director, was not happy with that. He wanted me to be only a reporter, not a commentator. But because of my position, I would contribute to the talk shows, plus on the air. And, you know, and they had to sort of balance off between the talk shows, but some of them didn't like each other, and you had to do... One of the things I did when I did the so-called investigative reporting was anything I got, I'd do it for the talk show as well as for the newsroom. For instance, the Davy Fulton story, you know... For one thing, you've got more latitude, more time.
More time to amplify on the story.
The tape and so on. I guess you know this in radio, too. We used to try and do things in 40 seconds. And I used to say, this will fit on a 40. You hear slamming. It went over the cart. It was 42. You know, I listen to, with respect, is people from, say, NBC, ABC. Their limit is 30 seconds. They can take a world story and do a very good job on it in 30 seconds.
That is the sign of a true broadcast artist.
Oh, is it ever. You know, I listen in awe to a lot of them. I'm still quite a fan of NBC, Today Show, their reporters, when they do their stand-ups and so on. I worry a bit about private radio in that, you know, I'm on the Webster Foundation and I'm a trustee, and I encourage private radio to make your submissions, and some do.
But there's so few with news departments anymore.
And if they do have a news department, it's two or three people, and there's very little time. But I do respect WX. I've talked to Jackie Donaldson, their news director, a couple of times about how she operates or how they operate. And she said, it's no excuse to say you don't have time. She said, with today's technology, you can save a story like that, and you can flag it for possible
archiving.
And the one organization that is doing a good job in news is CBC, CBC Radio and TV.
Now. Which is where Yvonne Emore is.
Yes, I'll be seeing her on that party at McKittrick's. CBC are winning most of the awards at the Websters.
Well, they still have staff.
Yes.
That's their bonus. They have people.
Yeah.
And you need people to do news.
Yeah, you do. And I watch, CBC TV and Global and so on, and Tony now is CBC. And it seems in CBC's case, they have a changeable rota of reporters. I keep seeing new ones all the time. Mm-hmm. Global, not so much. But in CTV, I guess they keep their people pretty well.
52. The business has changed.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So much.
Well, you know, we reminisce about it when we go to Red Robinson's RPM lunches. There's always a few jokes about people who were in radio, now retired or fired, whatever. Yeah.
George Garrett, thank you very much for your time today. This has been enlightening.
Oh, pleasure. Real pleasure, Mike.